Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us this hour, Jim McCormick, once again in our Ames studio, professor of politics at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim. Welcome back.
Hi, Ben. Thank you.
Joining us by phone, Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Hans, always glad to have you on as well.
It's fun to talk politics.
All right, it is indeed. And we do have another bounty of riches when it comes to political developments to chew over. We picked a few to do that with. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about more Donald Trump Jr. revelations, the statement that was issued about that contentious, controversial meeting last year. Also, another North Korean missile test putting the U.S. mainland within reach. We'll talk about that as well. And the question of whether the new chief of staff, John Kelly, will bring order to a reportedly chaotic White House. But first of all, just hours ago, President Trump signed into law legislation that levies new sanctions against Russia and restricts the president's own ability to ease sanctions in place against Moscow. Now, this is interesting to note. It's one of the first major pieces of legislation that was sent to the president's desk. The White House announced the signing this morning, saying the bill includes, quote, a number of clearly unconstitutional provisions that, in the words of the White House, purport to displace the president's exclusive constitutional authority to recognize foreign governments, including their territorial bounds. Let me add to this before we get comment. On Sunday, President Putin announcing that U.S. diplomatic missions in Russia will have to reduce their staffs by over 700 people as a retaliatory measure to the sanctions, which Putin then correctly assumed would be signed into law. Jim McCormick, make some sense of this, and also the president's reservations upon signing.
Well, this is something that's really been going on historically, where presidents sign legislation, and then they issue what's called a presidential signing statement, in which they raise objections to it. I don't think the signing statement has any legal standing. It is sort of a way of, I suppose, of various presidents to vent. But this has become sort of a subject of actually some political analysis as well of the number of times President George W. Bush had a very large number of signing statements. President Barack Obama had fewer. And, of course, this first piece of legislation that's really passed by the Congress of a significant nature has a signing statement. So maybe this is going to be a pattern that we'll see with President Trump. I think the other thing to note about this is this is very significant in terms of Congress making foreign policy, because if you look at the historical record, Congress usually basically endorses what the president, maybe with a little bit of tweak or maybe with a few procedural pieces of legislation. But this was really a substantive piece of legislation here and, as you know, passed overwhelmingly by both houses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Hans, what do you make of this first major piece of legislation sent to the president's desk?
Well, I think this is very interesting in that this is, in a way, a clear rebuke of Trump by Republicans. You hear a lot of criticism of Republicans saying, "Well, you're not standing up to Trump. You're not taking actions to denounce some of the things that he's done." Right? And kind of what I hear a lot from on the liberal side of commentary is, right, why aren't you voting against the new health care bill, or why aren't you taking a strong stand in favor of immigration? Right? These sort of things that are not conservative principles. And so it would be kind of odd to expect them to buck Trump's policy proposals when he's proposing things that they want. Whereas this really, I think, is a clear rebuke of the president by Republicans, saying, look, what you've done with Russia or what we've heard about Russia makes us very concerned. And so we're going to take these strong stances against Russia, even at the same time while you're lobbying and trying to push us to relax those sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the sanctions in place for Russia's action in Ukraine, invading Crimea, taking over there. Also, Russian meddling in our 2016 elections. Two of the parts of these sanctions, or the rationalization for the sanctions. Let's have you take us to Eastern Europe. Vice President Mike Pence traveled there for has been traveling there the last few days. Here he is speaking earlier this week, reassuring NATO allies that the U.S. is behind them.
To be clear, we hope for better days, for better relations with Russia. But recent diplomatic action taken by Moscow will not deter the commitment of the United States of America to our security, the security of our allies, and the security of freedom-loving nations around the world. And no threat looms larger in the Baltic states than the specter of aggression from your unpredictable neighbor to the east. At this very moment, Russia continues to seek to redraw international borders by force, undermine democracies of sovereign nations, and divide the free nations of Europe one against another. Under President Donald Trump, the United States of America rejects any attempt to use force, threats, intimidation, or malign influence in the Baltic states or against any of our treaty allies.
Okay, Vice President Mike Pence, and yesterday in Montenegro, reinforced that message.
America is honored to celebrate our relationship with the strong and free people of Montenegro. And let me assure you, I am here as a testament to the fact that America has no small allies, only strong allies. And I hope my presence here today affirms that.
Okay, Jim McCormick, talk about that visit and those words, which I'm sure you agree are in stark contrast to the words that the president has usually when speaking about Russia.
Absolutely. I mean, and also Vice President Pence went on to say that he fully endorses Article 5. And of course, we all know the difficulty that President Trump had in terms of endorsing Article 5 of the NATO treaty, which is, this idea of attack upon one as an attack upon all, and would call for an American response rather immediately. I think it's also significant, not only did he go to the Baltics, but he went, as your last piece there suggested, to Montenegro. And Montenegro, of course, is the newest member of NATO here. And this is, again, given where these countries are located, right on the border with Russia. And in fact, there's actually an exclave of part of Russia right next to Lithuania here. I think it's highly significant that Vice President Pence at this time made these kind of statements. Mm-hmm. Just one other thing to add, of course, there's also a report that by the end of the summer, the Russians are going to have exercises of 100,000 troops basically along this border in Belarus and in other parts of Western Russia here to demonstrate, I guess, their concern about expanding their influence.
Right. I've seen some maps where I forget the name of the tank division that has quite a history as being lined up there.
That's right.
On the side there. And this time there's no buffer. There's no sort of Ukraine and other countries were the buffer between Russia and the West. Now that buffer has been reduced. Hans, so it appears that Putin's attempt to meddle in our elections with the aim of creating a pro-Russia U.S. policy has completely blown up in Putin's face.
I mean, it seems like that, but I mean, I'm not sure necessarily that his purpose was exclusively to get a pro-Russia policy. I think part of his process probably was to try to think about how do you create enough chaos so that collective action is difficult. Well, in this case, there are some clear sanctions here, but I think at the same time, there's still a lot of leeway and there's still a lot of debate. When you look at polls among the Republican Party about what should be done with Russia, and there's no clear consensus. And so I think that
there's a clear consensus, but I mean, doesn't the near unanimity of these this sanctions vote in both houses demonstrate a common voice or not?
I think it does, but you also look at how public opinion has shifted among Republicans towards Russia. That's drastically changed. I'm not sure that maybe it's a short-term loss, but in some ways, perhaps by creating this partnership, and there may be some long-term goal, you know, long-term gain here.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you see it that way?
Well, I think they really have pulled Trump along here, the Republicans, in terms of what the Congress has done. And I think, as this goes on, and I think the American people will probably move in that direction of wanting to take a tougher stance. And I think actually it has created collective action on the part of the European states here. They are all arguing, and certainly the meeting that Pence had with the presidents of the three Baltic states suggests there's unanimity there. So I think they've really pulled them along. I mean, maybe there will be some division, but it's at least at the moment, I think they've pulled Trump along to this a much more staunch kind of policy. And even there's talk in recent days, as you may have seen, of the Americans sending offensive weapons to the Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm.
Other thing to think about too, Ben, is we're looking entirely at external international politics. So there may also be some internal benefit to Russia or to Putin's administration. You look back at instances like Argentina creating the Falklands War, right? And you've got situations where that for them was done not necessarily perhaps in part because they thought they could win, but also as a way to generate support for the current administration, the current group in power. And that may be something similar, right? When you're perceived as being under threat and under attack from other countries, there may be a kind of a rally around the flag within Russia, and that's hard to tell from where we're sitting right here.
Mm-hmm. Jim, talk a little bit about the different situation that Europe finds itself in these sanctions, also because of energy policy. The United States is dependent on Russian energy not at all, while Europe, Germany, for instance, has a great deal of dependence, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think the number is about a third of the energy supply of the Europeans really comes from the natural gas that the Russians provide here. And, of course, the other big story related to these sanctions, and I suppose part of it that why the Europeans are not exactly enthralled by these, at least the Western European countries are not enthralled with these new sanctions, is that part of the sanctions are going to be on some of the investors and some of the Russian companies that are building this Nord Stream pipeline that would go around Ukraine, would allow natural gas to be given to the Europeans without going through Ukraine, which, of course, has been a kind of a major stumbling block in terms of relations here. So that's part of the explanation why, say, Germany does not fully embrace these kind of new sanctions against Russia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Jim, also, going way back, you've been in political science for decades here.
Thank you.
Well, I'm drawing on your expertise there, too. I'm valuing that a great deal, Jim. I don't know how it came out with your laugh. I guess that's a little different. But we like the long view from our political scientists. And where I'm going with this is, how does this tension now, it's Cold War is often mentioned again. How did these tensions compare with the Cold War back in the time when Russia was at the heart of the Soviet Union?
I don't think we're quite there yet, which I'm happy about. I mean, I think there certainly is tension here, and Putin is, I suppose, as assertive as maybe Khrushchev tried to be prior to the missile crisis and so on. But I don't think the tension is there in terms of, the kind of sense of targeting one another that was so prevalent during the Cold War. But unfortunately, the unhappiness between American and Russian relations and the inability to get any kind of accommodation does mimic the Cold War. But I don't think the sense of tension and the kind of divided Europe that we saw so dramatically during the Cold War, we've not really reached that stage yet, would be my judgment.
Jim McCormick is with us, professor of politics at Iowa State University. Hans Hassel of Cornell College. Join us for our discussion of politics abroad and at home on this Politics Wednesday, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. We mustn't dally. We have a lot to get through. Our docket always packed these days. Let's talk about the reigning in the West Wing. Evidently, in his position as Homeland Security Secretary, John Kelly had griped for months about the disarray at the White House. Well, now he's been given the task of bringing order to the chaos. By the way, this is chaos that the president says does not exist. President Trump pointing to a buoyant stock market, a low unemployment rate as signs that his White House is working well. His tweet on Monday, no White House chaos. Also on Monday, the new chief of staff ended Anthony Scaramucci's short, wild ride through the White House as a communications director. Hans, why did the White House need a change from Chief of Staff Reince Priebus?
Well, I think that you've hit the nail on the head when you talked about the chaos or the lack of order that seems to be there. I think that they're struggling with the leaks that have been going on. I think that Trump and others probably viewed Priebus as not successfully managing some of the problems and the discord that was going on there. One of the interesting things that I follow a number of political reporters on Twitter. And one of the reporters in Minnesota that I follow recently talked about leaks. Was tweeting some thoughts about why leaks happen and how they're created. And her comment was that that unhappy organizations generally tend to leak more, right? Sometimes people leak information because they have some political purpose for it, or they have some goal in mind, some personal goal in mind. Other times it may just be because they've cultivated personal relationships with reporters and trust them. But her comment, right, was that unhappy organizations tend to leak more. And I think that this is that's a very clear indication of what's going on in the White House. Right,
right.
This is not a happy organization right now. And I think that's very clear, not just to us, but also to Trump and the leaders within that administration.
Right. Unhappy organization is one way to put it. If you judge by the last few days, especially Anthony Scaramucci, it might be an unhappy viper pit. Is more the picture that you get. Jim McCormick, can John Kelly, with his military background, force order here? Will he be the singular gateway to the president, as I assume is the role of the chief of staff?
Well, I think he has a real challenge. I mean, he obviously has some experience doing this, both in the military, given his kind of command positions, and also albeit with a short tenure at the Department of Homeland Security. So I think he has a chance to do that, but I suspect, or I hope, that he bargained with the president, saying that, you know, there will not be anybody walking into the back door to the White House here or to the Oval Office without him knowing about it. I think that was one of the problems that Priebus ran into. I think the other problem that Priebus ran into was that there was, and probably still remains, although there's been some ferreting out of the sort of the Republican establishment people within the White House staff, and more those that were really close to Trump. And so I think that if Kelly can ferret out some of those people that are not close to, that are part of the White House Republican establishment, in which I think we've already seen a couple of them leave, or maybe more than that, three or four of them leave, I think Kelly has a chance. But there's really got to be sort of discipline about who gets to see the president and how often, and whether the chief of staff knows that somebody is seeing the president and talking to the president. I think the real burden is, what about his son-in-law? What about his daughter in terms of President Trump, and how much access will they have to the Oval Office? So I think that's the sort of the major problem. I think these others that are in the White House staff, you can use the discipline of the office itself as chief of staff to stop those folks. But I think those personal relationships are really the problem.
Okay, let's listen quickly to the new White House chief of staff in his own words, a Marine who retired from the military 8 months before he was asked to be secretary for the Department of Homeland Security by President Trump. He says here, listen to him, from being in uniform, the switch from being in uniform to playing politics has been a transition. Here's something, a bit of what he had to say to CNN.
What I never saw on the military side was the level of toxic kind of politics that are associated with what I do now. Again, if they don't like the laws that we're enforcing, they should change them, or at least try to work with the other side to try to change the law. But I was not prepared for the level of, I've always believed, and in my last job, certainly as a uniformed person, I've always believed that honest men and women can disagree with each other on social issues, certainly political issues, and not hate each other. That's what I see in this job, where disagreements equal hate. They want your mother to die of stage 4 cancer or something. It's really, really vicious.
Okay, the new chief of staff at the White House, John Kelly. In the minute we have her, minute or less, tell us your outlook for this Hans Hassel, getting the White House into better order.
Well, I think the White House is always an area where people are competing to have the president's ear, and it's a difficult thing. And a lot of times that involves egos and people who believe that they should be heard. And I think he nailed the hammer on the head. I think that this is probably probably even worse in that there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of ordered structure compared to other presidents. And the question is whether he can bring that in there. And I'm not sure. He may have it. I think that Jim is right in some sense that having some of those divided battlegrounds between establishment and Trump kind of supporters gone may help a little bit. But I'm not. I think that this is that's an arduous task, and I don't envy his position at all.
Hans Hassel, stay with us. Jim McCormick, stay with us. Our political analysts on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. We'll be back in just a moment. Of course, let's go out into the break with this. Much political fodder for late-night comedians this past week. Here's Stephen Colbert singing a new version of Bohemian Rhapsody as an ode to fired White House communications director of only 10 days, Anthony Scaramucci.
Mama, I just got canned. Barely got to the White House. Said some dumb stuff, now I'm out. Mama, my job had just begun, and now I've gone and thrown it all away. Mama, ooh, didn't mean to cause outcry.
Also a little fun here on Politics Wednesday. Stephen Colbert there from a couple days ago. Hans Hassel, Jim McCormick back with me, Ben Kiefer, after this short break.
Thank you, John.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
And we're back with this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Hans Hassel of Cornell College, our political analyst this week, to chew over as much as we can get in our mouths and properly digest in analysis here. And there is far too much. So we're picking a few things, some of the top stories still to come. We're going to talk about Seth Rich. If you've heard that name, I want to talk a little bit about the controversy surrounding his slaying last summer and the political controversy involving Fox News. Also, North Korea. We're going to ask Jim about the situation with North Korea now that they've demonstrated a missile that could reach, could reach Iowa, definitely could reach Chicago, as shown by rocket scientists there, too. But first of all, let's talk a little bit about the latest revelation involving Donald Trump Jr. Yesterday, the White House said that Donald Trump had a role in producing a statement in which his son denied that a meeting he had with a Russian lawyer was related to the 2016 presidential campaign. Remember, this is the meeting from, I think, June of 2016. The comments that that evidently the president had a role in shaping here were shown later to be misleading. Jim McCormick, can you put this in a nutshell for us? How do you understand what is the latest revelation here in this controversy?
Well, this is the issue of whether the president himself worked to sort of write the statement or at least to dictate the statement that Donald Trump Jr. would give about the meeting, as you said, in June of 2016. You know, at least the accounts of it was by some of the lawyers is that they wanted a full statement about what happened at the meeting, and apparently, again, by the reporting by the Washington Post, is that President Trump sort of truncated the statement a bit to focus on the adoption of Russian children, and that was the whole point of the meeting. Of course, it came out later on that the meeting was initiated by the idea that there would be some kind of campaign information about Hillary Clinton that would be shared at the meeting.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to what the White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders had to say about this as they've been kind of catching up with what's been reported in the Washington Post and other publications.
Look, the statement that Don Jr. issued is true. There's no inaccuracy in the statement. The president weighed in, as any father would, based on the limited information that he had. This is all discussion, frankly, of no consequence. There was no follow-up. It was disclosed to the proper parties, which is how the New York Times found out about it to begin with. The Democrats want to continue to use this as a PR stunt and are doing everything they can to keep this story alive and in the papers every single day. The president, the American people, they voted America first, not Russia first, and that's the focus of our administration.
John, can you clarify the degree to which the president waited?
He certainly didn't dictate, but, you know, he, like I said, he weighed in, offered suggestion like any father would do.
Did he not know?
Okay, Hans Hassel, what do you think of that characterization put forth by Sarah Huckabee Sanders?
Well, it may be the truth, but it doesn't seem to be the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And I think that's the concern. And the other, I mean, the other question here is how important is this, right? He's not under an oath to tell the truth in these sorts of statements. This is not a statement coming, you know, directly from him. And so, you know, part of this question is, right, what's the consequence of this? I think that this really ultimately, you know, doesn't help his case when he's arguing that he's not trying to obstruct justice here.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, I'm not sure that it has a whole lot of, you know, legal implications beyond, right, lowering again the trustworthiness of statements that come out of the White House. And I think that's the biggest concern is that, right, if you continue to do these sorts of things, eventually people are going to say, right, how much can I actually trust information that's coming from there? And that's the concern. If the White House loses its ability to track news media and its ability to maintain itself as a place of solid information, then it becomes problematic as they try to convince and persuade.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick,
what struck me about this is that in some ways the White House doesn't seem to have learned very much over the course of these several months. I mean, did they really expect that the whole information about the whole ongoing meeting and what it was about would not come out? And to try to truncate it with a shortened statement, it just seems to me to not have their political antenna up very high.
Mm-hmm.
I think he continues to try to run this as a business where the implications of you know, minor spins and things like that aren't that big, and I think that this is a major issue that has been in the news and is a highlight of and you know, I think affects their ability to get any sort of legislative stuff done. And so the longer this remains, the harder it is for them to take, like, you know, a goal, achieve things legislatively.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, where do you stand on this idea of obstruction of justice? Isn't this another point that the special counsel Mueller will be looking into?
Well, I think he will. I'm sure he will in terms of, I don't know on a legal basis whether this rises to the point of obstruction of justice or not, because as Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, you know, what he said was up to the point, what he said was accurate about, there was discussion about this adoption. Now, whether Mueller will take it and say, you know, that this was incomplete and tried to throw off the investigators, then you move into the area of obstruction of justice. But I think it'll be a kind of a legal call here, which
I mean, this is also a public statement rather than a statement given explicitly under oath or to investigators, and so I'm not sure that it rises to that stature, but I don't think it helps with their credibility, and it
right.
definitely continues the story that the White House is trying to kind of to throw people off their trail.
Okay. If you're just tuned in, we're having Politics Wednesday, this edition of River to River with Hans Hassel of Cornell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Let's talk a little bit about the biting critique of his own Republican Party by Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. This in a piece in Politico. He's got a book that has come out, too, but the piece in Politico that he wrote titled, "My Party is in Denial About Donald Trump. We created him, and now we're rationalizing him. When will it stop?" Senator Flake starts his article this way. "Who could blame the people who felt abandoned and ignored by the major parties for reaching in despair for a candidate who offered oversimplified answers to infinitely complex questions and managed to entertain them in the process? With hindsight, it is clear we all but ensured the rise of Donald Trump." First of all, we don't know Jeff Flake in this part of the country very well. Hans, is he an outsider here? Is he reflecting what many Republican senators, lawmakers are thinking but not saying?
I mean, Jeff Flake is not someone that you would typically think of as a bomb thrower or someone who is, you know, outside the mainstream of the Republican Party. He's a strong fiscal conservative. He is a hawk generally. He's a social conservative, right? So he fits very well within the mainstream of the Republican Party. What strikes me about this, I mean, he has from the beginning been very wary of Donald Trump. I don't know if you remember back in when he was asked if he was going to go to the Republican National Convention, he said he had to go mow his lawn, right, in August in Arizona, right? I'm sure that's a wonderful place to be mowing your lawn as opposed to attending the convention. And so he's always sort of been this vocal, you know, opposition of Donald Trump. And what really struck me about this article was that, right, he called he's very much afraid. He says we need to be careful about sacrificing our institutions for short-term policy gains, right? And he calls this a Faustian bargain, and says we need to be careful, essentially, about accepting all of Donald Trump and some of the attacks that he's created against the institutional structure of our Constitution, and in exchange for, you know, short-term policy gains. He said that's not worth it, right? This is a Faustian bargain, and it's not worth it. And that's really what kind of stood out to me about this, is that he's saying we need to maintain our constitutional principles while at the same time achieving our policy gains.
Well, let's listen to the Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake last night on the PBS NewsHour speaking about his new book titled Conscience of a Conservative. Let's listen to a few of Jeff Flake's words.
Well, I think it's not conservative policy, and it's not conservative for elected officials, those of us in Congress, to watch this and not say anything. And I'm not saying that that everybody has remained silent. There have been many voices who have spoken up, but not enough. And what has gone on with the administration in terms of the chaotic atmosphere, that is not good for domestic policy. It's certainly not good for foreign policy.
Jim McCormick, what do you think? My feeling in the last 10 days, perhaps in the last 2 weeks, do you see any sort of a turning point in the relationship between the GOP and Trump? The GOP standing up more and more to Trump, less afraid to contradict him, as we see here in Jeff Flake's example?
Well, I think the two major issues that I would immediately cite, of course, was the sanctions bill that we talked about earlier. But I think also the health care bill. You know, the president was not able to sort of work his will on that, and seemed to be relatively impotent, it seems to me, in terms of he calls John McCain at the last moment, and there is not this kind of deference to the president immediately. But, of course, Flake actually voted for the health care bill. I think Flake was really concerned about staying with, you know, constitutional principles. And one of the constitutional conservative principles is, as Hans talked about, is to protect our institutions. And he really is, I think, also waving a little bit of a flag at the Congress for not acting out. He said in the past, the Congress has been willing across party lines to protect their institutional prerogatives. And that has been lost in this kind of very strong partisan environment. And so it's very interesting as a conservative, he's really calling for this kind of bipartisanship in protecting institutional standards.
I haven't seen anything to this effect, but Senator Flake have presidential aspirations himself, you think, Hans?
I mean, I don't think so. I think that at least not. It's not clear that he does immediately. I don't. That who knows? And we're looking at 2020, 3 years away at the earliest. I think that, I mean, along with Ben Sasse, his name has been floated by some kind of Never Trumpers as a possible primary challenger to Trump. Should Trump's inability to be effective continue, and his the scandals continue. You may see his name floated as someone who's kind of stood up at the beginning, but I mean, I think that right now, I think that this is something that started from the beginning of Donald Trump's campaign, that he just does not trust his actions and his words, and I think what Jim was saying about how what does Republican opposition look like to Donald Trump? Well, the power of the president, Richard Neustadt, writing in the 1960s, says the power of the president is the power to persuade. And it's very clear that power is not President Trump doesn't have that, right? He's not able to win over key votes in certain certain situations. He's not able to, you know, effectively manage leaks within his within the administration, and all sorts of other things that a president normally would be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just add, the title of Flake's book is A Conscience of a Conservative, as you said. And, of course, that title is from Barry Goldwater. Maybe he does have some presidential ambitions.
I think he actually, last night in the PBS NewsHour, he referenced Goldwater as he sees himself in that vein.
Yes.
Two other things quickly. We want to get to Seth Rich and also North Korea. To North Korea first, Jim McCormick, another North Korean missile test putting the U.S. mainland, Chicago, us in Iowa, within reach. Yesterday, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson saying the U.S. does not seek to topple the North Korean government, would like a dialogue with Pyongyang at some point, but only on the understanding that it can never be a nuclear power. What do you make of the latest in a series of missile tests by North Korea?
Well, I think on the part of the United States, there's really good cop, bad cop operating here. Because you notice also that just yesterday, the United States tested another missile into the South Pacific here. So and also there were some from Guam, there were some overflights of South Korea to demonstrate to the North the American expanse, if you will. Even at the same time, when Secretary Tillerson is saying that they'll want a dialogue with the North, so I think they're really trying to use both the stick and the carrot here to try to entice the North Koreans to move towards a negotiating table.
Mm-hmm. The president,
I'm very skeptical that the. No, you know, the North Koreans in the past, when they've come to and when they've even had any kind of bargaining, within really months or weeks, they've had sort of backed out of the deal. And so I'm skeptical that the diplomatic route will achieve very much. The only hope is, it seems to me, and I'll just add this one point, is that after China and after Xi Jinping has the party Congress here in September, maybe he'll have a freer hand. He'll feel stronger domestically to take action against the North Koreans. I think that's what the Americans might be counting on as well.
Donald Trump, President Trump tweeting, though, I am very disappointed in China. They do nothing for us with North Korea. Just talk. We will no longer allow this to continue. China could easily solve this problem. What about that last statement? Could China easily solve this problem? Or based on our prior discussions, Jim, that's not so easy.
Well, it's not so easy. You know, they have this. The Chinese have this very strong interest in not having a united Korea that would be Western looking rather than favorable to China here. So that's a real problem for them. They do, of course, have the economic leverage if they really wanted to use it to bring North Korea to its knees here, at least to bring it to a bargaining table because of the heavy dependence that the North Koreans have on China for the exports.
Mm-hmm. It's seen as, I guess, no good alternatives in this scenario. Jim, what do you deem to be the least worst scenario going forward for the North Korea situation?
Well, I think the what really has to continue to go forward. I mean, it's actually encouraging that Secretary Tillerson is talking about maybe having some kind of dialogue with them. You know, the North Koreans first of all have to have a commitment to do something about the nuclearization kind of question here, and also I think to move the Chinese. So that's the least bad option in this environment.
Hans, let's finish up with you talking about Seth Rich, a controversy surrounding the slaying. This happened last summer of a young data specialist at the Democratic National Committee. This week, though, on Tuesday, a private detective who investigated the slaying of this DNC committee staffer alleged in a lawsuit that Fox News Channel worked with the White House, worked with officials there to push a discredited theory about the case to undermine allegations of Russian collusion with the Trump presidential campaign. It's very involved. We only have a very few minutes. A complicated story. Hans, help us understand what's being alleged in this lawsuit and where are we at?
Yeah, so the story gained a whole bunch of traction a couple days ago, primarily because the lawsuit leads with a text from one of the collaborators that this private detective was working on who had connections in the White House. That said that President Trump had reviewed the story and really wanted to push it and wanted to get it out and hurried to get it out. And that's really why the story has gotten a whole bunch of news. The story that came out was ultimately proved to be false. And in the lawsuit, the private investigator alleges that Fox News put some words into his mouth that he didn't actually say as well. And so to kind of give the story more credence and more credibility. And so he says, as a result, my own credibility has been undermined and they've been using false statements. Mm-hmm.
How much import, it's getting a lot of headlines, how much importance does this have, implications going forward?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to, again, this goes back to trust in the administration. It's not entirely clear whether or not President Trump actually did review the story. And how much information that he knew, or even people in the head of his administration knew. They had a meeting with Sean Spicer at one point, but it's not entirely. There are disputes as to how much the story was discussed and whether the information was ever passed, elsewhere in the administration. Mm-hmm. And so this lawsuit is really a he said, she said. Who's actually telling the truth? Were they joking when they said this sort of thing? But it doesn't really lend, a particularly, again, this goes back to the credibility of the administration. This, again, lends the appearance that the Trump administration is trying to, push a different different angles and to try to get, investigation into the Trump campaign's connections with Russia kind of off the table. And that's really what this is about.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, we only have a minute. I'm sorry for that short amount of time, but speak briefly to Venezuela, an important vote that happened this past weekend under President Nicolas Maduro.
Yes, what happened was that there was this vote to create this constituent assembly that would write a new constitution here and basically disband the National Assembly that had been elected. And this is, of course, a way that is seen as allowing Maduro to take complete control because the National Assembly is composed two-thirds of opposition forces here. And it's seen as the solidification of a dictatorship by Maduro here within Venezuela here.
Right, right. And over the past few weeks, over 100 Venezuelans losing their lives in these protests. We'll keep an eye on that as well. Jim McCormick, professor of politics at Iowa State University. Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. Jim and Hans, thanks for being on board today and chewing through the politics with us.
Thank you very much.
There's a lot of chew. It's been fun.
All right, then. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.